Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Week one is almost in the books. It is Monday, September 9th, 2019. And what a fascinating and strange week one it was. I have to admit, I did not expect the most explosive offense in the NFL to be the Baltimore Ravens. I kind of expected the Dolphins to be a mess, but that's not exactly a impressive feat by me. Did not expect the least impressive offense in the NFL to be the Pittsburgh Steelers, who scored 3 points on Sunday night in a blowout loss to the Patriots. But we're going to get to that and a bunch of other stuff today and recapping most of week one. And joining me to do that is a good friend of the show. I would say now a professional emergency podcaster after his extensive podcast covering the Antonio Brown situation. It's our pal Will Brinson from CBS. Will, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. It's awesome to talk to you. It means that we're back in the swing of the regular season. And yes, we did four Antonio Brown podcasts. Another Antonio Brown meltdown emergency podcast. Antonio Brown will play in week one emergency podcast. Antonio Brown released by Raiders emergency podcast. And Patriots sign Antonio Brown emergency podcast. Everyone can find those in the Pick Six podcast feed on iTunes. I host it five times. Actually, it's going to be – we're doing it because we're doing Monday night and Thursday night previews with Jared Dubin. Mm-hmm. We're actually doing seven shows a week, which is seems a little bit excessive, but people seem to like it, so we'll go with it.
That's incredible. We were covering the Antonio Brown situation on here. We know it's once a week during the off season, so like five things would happen between each of our podcasts. But no, I mean, it was a very sort of just – otherworldly strange experience to see the Antonio Brown situation develop over the past few weeks. And then it's also strange to think about now the Patriots, who don't seem to really need Antonio Brown, are getting him after a really impressive week one performance, a week one victory over the Steelers. And I mean, let's start there in terms of the Patriots. Are you scared? I mean, did you see this sort of performance coming from them?
Hell no, I didn't. And because I'm like, I was about to go, well, in the preseason, I did agree that their defense looked excellent against the Panthers, and therefore they might be good. No, I like picked the Steelers and maybe wagered on the Steelers. So no, I didn't see it coming at all. I'm an idiot. And I'm scared because the Steelers are my AFC Super Bowl pick. I think if the scarier thing, Bill, is that this team, which in April, you know, after the season, it's like, okay, they won another Super Bowl, but they sort of patched it together. Let's see what they can do this coming year. Yeah, they lost Gronk. They don't have a great bunch of receivers. It was basically Edelman, Julian Edelman, Philip Dorsett, and Maurice Harris with the top of their depth chart. And now it's like Antonio Brown, Josh Gordon, Edelman, Demaryius Thomas, Jacoby Myers, my NC State guy who looks very good as a rookie, and Philip Dorsett. They're loaded on offense. But I think the bigger storyline, honestly, Bill, is that this defense that Bill Belichick has put together is smothering on the back end. It feels like he's sort of quietly been, now that we've, and this maybe this is a week one overreaction, I don't think it is, but it feels like he's been building towards this development of defensive backs to the point that he can play, he can lock down. I mean, Ben Roethlisberger was completely, he had no one open.
Right.
They locked down Juju Smith-Schuster, and they just said, beat us with your other weapons, but unfortunately, we're going to cover them on the back end, too. You're going to have to hold the ball, and then try to chunk it deep, you know, best case scenario. I mean, it was stunning to see the defensive performance they put on against the Steelers. Ben Roethlisberger and Mike Tomlin, they had no answers. And that to me would be the scarier thing if I'm anybody else in the AFC, because typically speaking, for the Patriots to win a Super Bowl, it requires their defense to sort of coalesce as the season goes along, to get hot at the right time, to get into that final quarter of the season, knowing that they have all the right pieces, and then to play really well in the playoffs. What if they're just great out of the gate in 2019? That's terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I forget who tweeted it. I don't know if it was you. It might have been Shil Kapadia. I'm not sure who it was exactly, but tweeted something to the effect that this hasn't been a top 10 defense by DVOA in a long time. I mean, over a decade, I believe. I think there is this reputation that the Patriots are a team that have a defensive genius as a head coach, and so they have good defenses, and they occasionally have. But like you said, usually it's they struggle with some injuries. They have a cornerback who's not playing all that well. And then sort of in the second half, and especially the final month of the year in the postseason, they seem to get healthy and figure things out. But
this was a really impressive performance. And it wasn't like they were dominating up front and just destroyed the Steelers with their pass rush. I mean, they had one sack and three quarterback knockdowns of Ben Roethlisberger, who, I mean, outside of his one scramble, isn't exactly the most mobile quarterback out there. And, you know, maybe it's a different game if the Steelers get more out of Dante Moncrief, who had a couple drops. He was 3 of 10 for 7 yards as a receiver. Obviously, an ideal start to his Steelers career. But, I mean, if you told me before the game, hey, the Patriots are going to have one sack on 48 Roethlisberger dropbacks. They're going to have Sony Michel run 15 times for 14 yards. I would have assumed they would be in trouble. I would have assumed that the way they were going to win that game was getting pressure on Roethlisberger and running the football effectively. And the other running backs were better, I think it's fair to say. Rex Burkhead and James White had 12 carries for 70 yards. But, I mean, you know, outside of some very early misses, Tom Brady was fantastic in this game. And Josh Gordon is going to be a problem. I don't know if he's going to be there all season. I don't know if he's going to be there every single week, getting the sort of targets you might need to be a wide receiver one in this league. But, I mean, Josh Gordon on 3 receptions, you know, looked like he was absolutely uncoverable for the place where he was throwing the football.
What do you think is going to happen when they do add Antonio Brown to this? Because we were having this debate on the podcast, and I think this is one of those things where there is a really, really wide variation on outcomes. I think it was reported just before we started talking that $9 million signing bonus for Antonio Brown, $5 million now, $4 million later. Yes. I think that says a lot to me, Bill, in the sense that the Patriots feel the same way that we all do, which is we don't know how this is going to work out. And when I look at what the Patriots have in terms of their, their offensive targets, right? Like, Julian Edelman had 11 targets and 6 catches. But nobody else that's a wide receiver, James White had 7 targets and Rex Burkhead had 8. Nobody else that's a wide receiver had more than 4. So would Antonio Brown be okay with 4 targets, 4 catches, 95 yards, and 2 touchdowns? I mean, on a weekly basis, yes. Is he going to be okay if he's not the guy? Because, you know, as Steelers fans will tell you, Bill, this is somebody that has, you know, typically cared more about his own personal statistical production and business being booming and whatnot than he has technically team wins. So I'm curious what you think where's the range of outcomes here and what's most likely?
And you remember the Antonio Brown 5-catch, 50-yard streak that kept the nation entranced for so many weeks a couple of years ago. You know, I mean, you also mentioned the contract situation. He also has incentives that are worth $1.5 million each for 105 catches, 1,298 yards, and 16 touchdowns. I mean, the catches and the touchdowns I see as difficult to pick up. The yards might not be all that crazy if he does play well over the rest of the season. I think it's going to be a week-to-week thing, and I think, you know, certainly you would figure Bill Belichick's going to have to communicate that to Antonio Brown. He's going to have to say, hey, you know, there are going to be weeks where we're going to run the football if we're up late in games, and you're going to have to be okay with that. I think the structure of that deal, knowing that it's a two-tiered signing bonus, you know, is sort of telling in how much the Patriots necessarily have faith in that working out. But I think winning cures a lot of ills. Doesn't cure all ills, and it could be a situation where Antonio Brown seems fine for most of the year, and then, you know, if the Patriots lose and he has a 2-catch game, we get that sort of, you know, Antonio Brown stewing. He'd been stewing all season, and finally it comes out in one big burst. But I think Antonio Brown is going to get the football. I do think they're going to have to find a way to, you know, move him around the formation. I think you don't want to compromise Julian Edelman's effectiveness in the slot. I think about the Eagles situation from a year ago, where you had Golden Tate come in and he was a slot receiver. You had Zach Ertz, who was effective in the slot. You had Nelson Aguilar, who was effective in the slot. And Tate sort of got lost in the shuffle because the Eagles, you know, sort of forced him into situations where he wasn't going to be playing his best football, and then, you know, sort of compromised the rest of their offense and then decided to sort of freeze Tate out a bit. I think you can't really do that with Antonio Brown, given how much you're paying him and given his personality. But I do think you're going to have to sacrifice across the board. You know, I think Josh Gordon might have been a guy who became a 10 target a game receiver for the Patriots as he got back into game shape. He was sort of approaching that volume last year before he left the team, and I don't think that happens now. I think Edelman doesn't have a lot of 15 target games. Maybe he doesn't have a ton of 11 target games like he had yesterday. you know, Sony Michel, who might have been in line to have a 280 carry season if he stayed healthy. It's tough to see him getting that. I think they're going to throw the ball more frequently with Antonio Brown, but you know, I do think that winning cures a lot of evils. And so I do think that as long as the Patriots are winning and playing the way they did this weekend, I do think even given that Antonio Brown might grumble a little bit here and there, I think it's not going to be a really destructive thing unless the Patriots do start struggling to actually win football games.
I want to believe that, because it's the Patriots. It's like I'll believe it. I'll listen to it. I think it is fascinating that this team might have some similarities to 2007, and I know that again that is week one hyperbole, but there is a they came out and smashed one of their top two or three competitors in the conference. One of the teams is going to be competing for the first overall seed in Pittsburgh. They look like a juggernaut offensively. They have a ton of weapons. They have this future Hall of Fame wide receiver who was cast off from a terrible Raiders situation and ended up in their laps on a fairly cheap price. You know, they have a defense that looks like it's flying under the radar and might be able to lock people down on a weekly basis. Their schedule, Bill, over the next...
I was going to say...
It's a joke. I mean, like, this comes down to, can the Chiefs keep Patrick Mahomes healthy, get Tyreek Hill back? Are the Ravens a legitimate threat? And if the answer to either of those is no, then they're walking away with this first seed, because it's at Dolphins, Jets, at Bills, at Redskins, Giants, at Jets, before Browns and at Ravens, before they get to the Week 10 bye. I mean, I feel fairly confident in saying that 7-0 is not even a reasonable outcome, but a likely outcome.
You would say, if you had to pick a record for the Patriots heading into that Browns game, you would say 7-0. I think that's the most likely outcome, yeah. Like you said. I don't think it's, you know, it's certainly not guaranteed. They could slip. I mean, they've lost to the Dolphins in Miami in years past. I don't know if that's going to happen this year. I would be pretty impressed. I think that would be a very unlikely outcome. But, you know, I mean, they could slip against the Bills, who looked really good on defense yesterday against the Jets. The Jets themselves, you know, were pretty good for most of the game until C.J. Mosley went down. We'll talk about the Dolphins and the Ravens a little bit later. You know, I mean, this is a team that looked phenomenal and looked like they can do everything pretty well. I mean, they held James Conner to a terrible game. They really, really stifled Ben Roethlisberger with coverage. And we'll see. I mean, maybe it's just Bill Belichick had the entire offseason to prepare, and the Steelers did not have a alternative with Juju Smith-Schuster after, you know, given the rest of the receivers on their roster. But this is a scary football team. How about
the idea that they lose to the Giants in Week 6? Because, like, wouldn't that be fitting? Like, Eli gets them one more time.
I think you're very optimistic to believe that Eli.
Or more likely, they end Eli's career. Daniel Jones starts Week 7 against the Redskins for the Giants.
If you're the Giants, I don't want to talk a lot about the Giants today, mostly out of my own personal sadness. But if you're the Giants, do you want to save Daniel Jones until after that game because you don't want to subject him to like a 45-3 defeat?
By the way, the other thing about that Patriots schedule too, Bill Belichick's record. I don't have it in front of me because I just don't want to Google it really fast. But his record against quarterbacks under the age of 27 is ridiculous. It's like 193-4 or something.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's not really that big, but it's really ridiculous. And the Jets and Bills both have those quarterbacks. We might see Dwayne Haskins by then. We might see Daniel Jones by then. So no, I wouldn't want to do that. I would trot out Eli Manning, give him one last shot, like an old gunslinger limping into the saloon for one last fight with the old villain. And I think too, like, after that game for the Giants, you know, you look at, they get the Cardinals the next week, at the Lions, Cowboys are tough, and then at the Jets before their bye. I would think those four games would be decent spots to start Daniel Jones.
We, by the way, we should do this now, I think. We talked about this yesterday on Twitter. We saw Ben Roethlisberger scramble for seven yards yesterday. We saw Eli Manning go on a naked bootleg on 4th-and-1 for the Giants, which, I mean, looked great on paper until you realize that it was Eli Manning trying to run to the edge and make a pass.
It was the perfect juxtaposition of the Giants are trying to use Eli on a naked boot on 4th-and-1, and the Cowboys are play actioning on a leak screen to Jason Witten. It's like the Cowboys have passed the Giants. I mean, they're a smarter football team than the Giants right now, and that's not what I think anybody would have thought 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's not particularly close, sadly. Yeah. Just being aware of what you have on offense. The Cowboys have more talent, but they're also making a lot better use of that talent. I don't know. Did Philip Rivers run at all yesterday? I didn't watch enough of the Chargers game, especially the Chargers offense.
Yeah, this is why I thought of it, because he had one run. I need to look it up. He had a run that was like a scramble up to the right. And I'm pretty sure, unless I'm imagining this, but it was like similar to what Ben Roethlisberger had, mm-hmm. where and like I was like, man, I was like, Ben looks thick. He looks thick, and he's moving a little slow. And look, as a fellow, I'm thick. I don't mind criticizing a 38 year old man for having a dad bod. I'm right there with him. I was like, man, do you know what? I think Rivers. 10 years ago it wouldn't have been close. I think now, yeah, Phil might be able to hang his own. He's not listed as a rush, so maybe I'm imagining this, but I'm picturing them all running together at the same time in that scramble that Ben had, where he took like extra time to get up to steam.
Yeah.
And I feel like Rivers out of the gate, maybe a little bit faster, and Eli just needs something to prove. He needs a win right now, so I could see Eli actually giving it his all in this foot race.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ben was like a car that maybe, someone tried to drive a car that didn't know, tried to drive a manual and didn't know how to change gears and thing. Just sort of moved at, a nice low speed for the majority of that run.
It lurched out.
Sort of accelerated, not especially. Eli's never been fast. I think he was efficient, but it just felt like Eli was taking 3 steps to move at the speed of a normal quarterback for every 1 step that someone like a Dak Prescott would take. It was not pretty. And then, we all know the Philip Rivers injury. We all know the famous story. He won a playoff game without an ACL, ended up getting surgery after the week and then came back and played the following week. Clearly not a fast man, even in his younger days.
He wasn't fast in college. If you watch highlights of Philip Rivers in college, he's not fast. Like, he's tall. He's got a funky arm motion. He can throw it far. He's not fast. Never has been. Never will be.
And certainly the knee injury did not help. But I feel like we've now come around where maybe a decade ago, Ben Roethlisberger would have been able to use his length to win this race. Eli Manning, had better footwork, would have been able to use – he's maybe in the best athletic shape of the three, which seems strange to say, but I would say is probably fair. Philip Rivers, I think, slow and steady, has in fact won the race. I would pick Philip Rivers now.
Wow. Maybe Rivers would be – it depends on the distance. If it's like 40 yards, I think it's Ben, because once he gets up to steam, he's going to be moving the fastest. If it's just 10 – if we're doing a 10-yard split, I think that Ben would be like minus 110. Rivers would be – just because people would be betting on it, right? He'd be the public favorite. I think Rivers would be plus 150, and Eli would be like 2.5 to 1 is what I would handicap it at if I was putting the odds down on a 10-yard split run. If it's a full 40, I think Ben is the fastest. Maybe he's in the worst shape and he just can't keep going for 40. But I think Ben would be closer to like minus 200 at 40 yards.
Okay, so let's say we're going to have each run a 40-yard dash tomorrow or at the end of the season for public consumption. How much do you think you'd have to pay each guy for them to actually agree to do this?
It'd be like that Phil Mickelson Tiger golf match. It's like $10 million.
They've got a lot of money.
None of those guys are doing it for less than $1 million.
Absolutely, I would at least $1 million. Not like the Marquis Goodwin $1 million that he didn't actually get because it didn't work out. Like, you need $1 million in a suitcase, tax free, before the race even runs.
That's right. No, I think they would do it. I mean, what if we stacked $1 million at the end of the line? Would they race for $1 million, or would Eli be like, I'm not beating those guys. I'm not doing this for $1 million. I'm going to humiliate myself. Are you crazy? Or would they need, like, if you gave them $1 million each, and then we had $5 million at the end of the line, in this hypothetical scenario, would they all agree to do it?
I think this needs to be like the World Series of Poker. To your point, like, there needs to be a pile of money.
That's what I mean.
Like, yeah, exactly. Right.
And like the lumbering, like whoever finishes first can just fall into the giant pile of cash.
I'm just picturing a finish line made of $1,000 bills that they're going to. This is great. I'm in. I don't know if we're going to be able to find $8 million to make this happen, but I'm happy to contribute $20 to the GoFundMe.
Me too. I'm in. Yeah. So let's start a GoFundMe. You and I will fire it up, and then we'll make sure that we'll make sure that we get these guys on board.
All right, well, let's get to more of the NFL action and the most stunning quarterback performance from week one in a moment. But first, guys, hiring can be a slow process. Cafe El Toro's CEO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. You can understand, it's not exactly a obvious path to find a director of coffee. So Dylan switched to ZipRecruiter, because ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. And he also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants, so he could focus on the most relevant ones. That's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in a matter of days. That sounds pretty awesome. You can see why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes by trying ZipRecruiter for free at our exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. That's my last name, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. This was a disastrous performance. I didn't expect this to happen. I sort of figured the Dolphins would give more of an effort. And I think the players were trying hard. I don't think there was a lack of care or concern. There's very little talent here in offense. And the secondary, the talented players in the secondary were marginalized by a lack of a pass rush and a truly, truly, at least to me, impressive performance from Lamar Jackson in this game. A 59-10 blowout of the Miami Dolphins. Lamar Jackson, 17 of 20 for 324. Five touchdowns, five passing touchdowns from Lamar Jackson. I went back and watched this game and talked about it in my column today. Interested to hear what you think, Will. How much of this do you think was Lamar Jackson playing impressively, and how much of it was the Dolphins just being an absolute mess?
Well, first I want to say that I am, as I usually am on Monday, Bill, jealous of your column idea. You took five quarterbacks and broke them down, just really smart. Credit to you.
Thank you.
It's like what Dak, Lamar, Baker, Josh Allen, Kyler Murray. It's like those were the big storylines of the day. So I'm just telling you, it was a very smart column idea. I was jealous you did it. I wish I'd thought of it. Interesting to note, over the last 3 years, John Harbaugh's Ravens teams in week one have a plus 93 point differential.
That's good.
Just in week one. It's worth noting. I mean, two of those with Flacco, one with Lamar. As far as the percentage of blame that I would place on the Dolphins versus Lamar, I would give Lamar and the Ravens and Greg Roman and John Harbaugh 75% of the credit.
Wow,
I think
sure.
That against an average NFL team, that they are still doing a lot of damage, and that this team, as it's constructed, does not have the talent. And there were instances where it was very clear that they were just being overwhelmed by Baltimore. But what I found so fascinating, and I think that this is why I believe that this can continue, is that it's really interesting to see how the Ravens have embraced analytics, mm-hmm. and yet we're theoretically going with this run-first approach with this run-first quarterback. But digging into it, so they run all this stuff out of shotgun where they're using RPOs and play action and however you frame it. It's a funky offense featuring a quarterback who can run the ball a lot. Mark Ingram, from 2016 to 2018, had 93 carries out of shotgun for 493 yards. Mm-hmm. That is 5.3 yards per carry, 239 yards after contact, 27 first downs. So that's 29% of his runs out of shotgun results in a first down.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Hill at Oklahoma State last year, 153 carries out of shotgun, 909 yards. That's 5.9 per carry. And 23.5% of his runs resulted in a first down. If you look, you can look all this, you know, Sports Info Solutions has all this stuff on, mm-hmm. you can break it down by shotgun. Gus Edwards way up there in terms of the numbers in shotgun last year, which leads me, the point is that when they put Lamar Jackson in shotgun and they make him a viable running threat, but also a viable passing threat who can throw quick and can throw deep with accuracy, and you also have to worry about the run, if you're a subpar defense, you are going to be eviscerated.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in Miami. You could see it on the first Marquise Brown touchdown play. They ran a play action out of the shotgun, draw to the right, and the Miami defenders just come flying in at Mark Ingram because he lit them up for 50 yards on the first carry.
Right.
They come flying in, Hollywood breaks out and then fakes outside and comes back inside. Lamar hits him quick on the hit right in the belly, and he's gone. And I just think that that is a sustained. This is I was wrong. This I said. I liked the Ravens once we got closer to the season. Mm-hmm. I was wrong initially. I thought they would do what they did down the stretch last year, and it would be unsustainable over the course of a full season. But Bill, this is an offense that can work. And if Lamar is as accurate as he was against Miami, there were times where, like that one touchdown pass to Miles Boykin, where he had no business throwing it up.
Sure.
And Boykin had no business being uncovered. But by and large, I do think that this is they can throw so many looks at you in the run game and at these mesh points that it is going to be really difficult for offenses to adjust over at least the course of the season, as long as Lamar is progressing as a passer, which it appears that he is.
Yeah. I mean, a really good point about the building a roster that makes sense and having players who complement one another in the sort of core concepts you want to do. I mean, there are teams like, you know, you read about Washington, Jay Gruden complaining that, Adrian Peterson is invaluable because he doesn't want to run, you know, out of the I formation 50 times in a game. And it's like, well, I don't know how much control you have over the roster, Jay, but like you're paying him money. So if you don't think that's all he can do and that's what you don't want to do on offense, it seems dumb to have him on your roster. Maybe it's just ownership forcing him to play Adrian Peterson. It seems like after Darius Geis got injured, the Washington may have to resort to 55 I formation runs a game. But, you know, this is a team that I think, even if they're not running this sort of offense, that might be, you know, the prototypical pass 70% of the times with Patrick Mahomes because analytics says so. Well, they're building an offense that actually plays to their, you know, star player strengths. And, you brought up that first touchdown pass. That's a great throw from Lamar. It's an RPO I think they stole from the Chiefs, according to Ted Wynn, you know, where you have an outside zone and you have the backside slants and you have a guy in Hollywood Brown who is going to make people miss. He's not going to necessarily have an 80-yard touchdown every week, and Lamar's not necessarily going to put a pinpoint perfect throw 40 yards downfield, but, you know, he's going to scare teams with his speed. Mark Andrews, who was 8 of 8 for 108 in a touchdown yesterday, you know, it's a guy who isn't necessarily a great blocker, but someone who is going to threaten teams as a receiver and someone who, you know, his presence on the field is not necessarily going to reveal what the Ravens are going to do on offense. So I think there is there is certainly a ecosystem here that makes sense and works. It might not work quite as effectively as it did against the Dolphins, but I mean,
probably not,
but the concepts here make sense. And the broader offensive idea seems to make a lot of sense. I really do feel like he doesn't have to be all that great of a passer. He doesn't have to hit 70% of his passes or 68% of his passes to be a worthwhile player. It's sort of a similar thing to Josh Allen in Buffalo, where if he can contribute as a runner and he can contribute by making bigger plays downfield, well, 60% might be a viable completion percentage. And when he hits 85%, like he did in week one, you know, he's going to have monster games. And I'm someone who had a lot of faith in Lamar Jackson playing at this level, and I don't think week one proved he can do it, but I think it was a nice little riposte to people who were skeptical of him after the playoff loss last year.
I said this on our CBS Sports HQ, but I think it's really, really important, and it's not going to matter because eventually it's just going to happen. Mm-hmm. But when we start discussing these 2018 quarterbacks, Lamar Jackson's been on the outside looking in. Like, we talked about the big four. It was Rosen, Allen, Mayfield, and Darnold. And that's that because of draft slot. That is the wrong way to approach it. Lamar Jackson needs to be in there. And I this is a real big week one overreaction, but you can make the case that maybe he could be the best one by the end of the season. I don't think it's likely, but he has, you mentioned the ecosystem. He is surrounded by guys who complement his skill set really well. And he has a smart offensive coordinator who has had success at this level with quarterbacks with a similar skill set. He has a what looks like might be a better Ravens defense than we'd seen in the past few years, even on the other side. And meanwhile, Baker Mayfield is getting destroyed in the end zone by Cameron Wake, who's 97 years old. And, Josh Allen has a terrible first half and Sam Darnold is okay. I mean, like, I get it. It's just week one. But I think it would be disingenuous not to include Lamar Jackson in the group of those quarterbacks when we are discussing the draft class and who can be the best out of that group.
Yeah. And you look at his rushing numbers as a starter, His rushing attempts by game as a pro, 26, 11, 17, 14, 18, 13, 20, 9 in the playoff loss. On Sunday, he ran the ball 3 times for 6 yards, yeah. And one of them was a kneel down. He was not, you know, really threatening the Dolphins as a runner in this game. He was almost exclusively
the same number of runs as he did in completions.
Right. I mean, you know, this was a game where he was basically a drop-back passer or a shotgun passer. I'm skeptical of the defense. You know, obviously they played great against the Dolphins. This is the, I wrote in my column, the Eagles' backup offensive line might be better than the Dolphins' starting offensive line. And it might not be all that close. I mean, it's an absolutely brutal, brutal offense. I think the defense is going to have better days. I think the secondary, is going to have better days against maybe less impressive offenses in the weeks to come. But if you're the Dolphins, I mean, are you just so far into the tank at this point that if a team offers you a trade for someone who's not going to be around in a couple of years, someone like a Devontae Parker or, you know, maybe a Rashad Jones, but I don't know if someone's going to take on his salary. Would you make that trade even though it's taking one of the few pieces of talent off of your roster at this point?
I think you have to. Miami is in a very bad spot. You know, when we talk about tough schedules or easy schedules, hard schedules, the Dolphins have the Patriots at home next week. Then they're at the Cowboys, and then they have the Chargers in week 4 before a week 5 bye. So enjoy September. It should be a blast. Their point differential is going to be like -200 by the time we get to October. Redskins, Bills, Steelers, Jets out of the bye is much better. But yeah, I think if you're Miami, you need to embrace the, I mean, there was a report from Mike Florio that like everybody's saying we want out.
Right.
I mean that's unfortunate, but you need to identify your core pieces of talent and sit these guys down and say, look, this is not going to be a fun season. We're going to be better. We're going to work hard. You are a key part of this organization. We are trying to build something special here, but it's going to take time, and we're not going to try and flip a switch overnight because it's just not feasible. I do think it is interesting that they appear to be waiting at least until week 6 to start Josh Rosen. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a problem with that. I know you want to see 16 games of him. I think he would have been overwhelmed yesterday. I think he'll be overwhelmed against the Patriots. He'll be overwhelmed against the Cowboys, overwhelmed against the Chargers. And so I'm okay waiting, but they don't, if this Fitzpatrick thing lasts, into the middle of October, it merits a serious inquiry as to why they would not want to evaluate Josh Rosen over as long a period as possible.
I know both are unlikely, and I don't want to suggest that either of them are likely to happen. But if you had to pick, do you think the Patriots are more likely to go 16-0 or the Dolphins are likely to go 0-16?
As soon as you said both are unlikely, I was like, you're going to ask the Patriots undefeated or Dolphins winless.
I think,
oh boy. I mean, both are unlikely. I would say that it is more likely that the Patriots go undefeated.
Really?
Even though they have the Ravens, Eagles, and Chiefs left, because I think I just see a couple of spots on here for the Dolphins where it's and the Bengals, by the way, looked actually pretty good. I probably won't talk about them today, but they were better than I thought.
Yeah,
the Bengals
sure.
at home, the Bills at home, the Jets at home, and the Redskins at home. That's 4 teams in the middle to bottom tier of the NFL that I think they could jump up on and steal one from just because of the randomness of NFL games. And so I think Miami will get 1 or 2. I would not be feeling good about the over if I took it at 5 right now. No. But I think they can actually steal a couple.
Yeah, I did bet the Dolphins. I put $10 on the Dolphins to win the division at 80-1. and I don't know if those odds are necessarily they seemed high at the time. I don't think they're quite as high after 1 week.
Last night when the Steelers got the ball down 7-0 with like 4.5 minutes left, I bet the Steelers for $25 to have the lead at the end of the first quarter at 100-1. That didn't go over very well. But I just like the odds. You know?
Yeah, well, of course. FPI, by the way, says the Patriots have a 0.6% chance of winning out. Ooh. The Dolphins, 1.9% of going
0-16.
Okay. Right. So same ballpark to me. I would probably lean towards the Dolphins just because I think they might not be This is the healthiest Dolphins team we're going to see all year. Put it that way. You know, there's a chance that what happens if they lose Xavien Howard or if they lose Minkah Fitzpatrick or Ryan Fitzpatrick gets hurt and they're stuck with Josh Rosen and he's bad, or they trade Devontae Parker or lose Allen Hurns or trade Kenyon Drake. I mean, This could be the most talented Dolphins team we see all 16 weeks, which is kind of scary. Let's hit a break, though. We have a lot more to talk about. A couple of surprising quarterback performances and a surprising running game to talk about after the break here on the Bill Barnwell Show. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. I'm joined by CBS's Will Brinson, making his contractual monthly appearance here on the show. And let's talk about another AFC North team. And I think if you'd figured one team in the AFC North was going to have their young quarterback break out with a 5-touchdown game in week one, you would have figured it was Baker Mayfield and the Cleveland Browns. And that did not turn out to be the case.
No, it did not, Bill. I actually will, I'll take a little victory lap here.
Yeah.
I'm the only, I don't know if I'm the only person in the country. I know I'm the only person in CBS Sports to pick the Titans to win outright. And, I actually on Friday afternoon, I published my picks on Friday, my best bets. And, the Titans plus 5 was one of them. And, I went out and had I've been working for like 48 straight hours with all the Antonio Brown stuff. And I said, I'm going to be having an IPA or two, an adult beverage or two.
Sure.
I got home post IPAs and I was catching some heat on Twitter and I started kind of firing at people who were giving me heat. Like, how dare you? You pick the Titans? Your analysis is utterly worthless. Why would you even, I'll never listen to anything you say again. It's like, first of all, buddy, it's an NFL football game with a 5-point spread. Anything, there is any outcome is on the table. Okay. And second of all, I feel vindicated in that the two things that concerned me the most about the Cleveland Browns heading into 2019 were, one, the offensive line.
Yep.
They cut their left tackle like a week ago. They cut him. They cut him because they knew he would come back because Greg Robinson had nowhere else to go, and he knew he was going to come back to Cleveland. And then two, and I don't mean this as an indictment of Freddie Kitchens by any stretch of the imagination, because I think he's I love him. Like right. I would want him to be my head coach. But I think the fact that he is dealing with the play calling, they're incorporating a new offense. He is a second year quarterback with a ton of film on him. And he is also taking on the responsibility of being a first time head coach.
Yep.
It's a lot to bear. And to me, it appears that both of those things caught up with the Browns in a big way in week one, including, you know, I mean, look, this is a little intangible, but at some point, you know, if you're the Titans, and all you're doing all offseason is reading these GQ magazines where the Browns are, you know, fur coats and puffing their chest up and they're the Super Bowl favorites. I mean, if you're Tennessee, you feel totally disrespected. And I think they came out and played that way and they got pressure on Baker Mayfield. And if he takes hits like he took in week one, which is what he was taking when he first stepped in for Hugh Jackson, this is going to go south on them quickly. And I think that it is they can mitigate it. They can do stuff offensively, you know, quicker throws. There are ways to fix it, but I would be very concerned if I was a Browns fan right now.
Yeah. I mean, this was the exact sort of script you would craft if you were someone who was skeptical of the Browns heading into this season. Not that you're thinking they're going to be bad, but just if they're going to lose games, this is how they're going to lose games. It was to a T, this sort of game. To your point about Freddie Kitchens, the Browns didn't adjust in this game. This was a game where they lost Greg Robinson, who was not a great left tackle, has penalty issues.
He hands for somebody.
Right.
Hell,
he kicked somebody on the ground. Myles Garrett might have been, perhaps should have been ejected for punching a Titans player, early in the first half. And, they lose Greg Robinson. They replace him with Kendall Lamb at left tackle. Chris Hubbard's having a nightmare at right tackle. Cameron Wake, who you mentioned earlier, incredible in this game, a phenomenal debut in a Titans uniform. But Lamb gets injured on the safety that Baker Mayfield took. They move Chris Hubbard over to the left side. Austin Corbett, the guy they took in the first pick of the second round in the first John Dorsey draft, who they traded Kevin Zeitler to presumably open a spot for, was a healthy scratch this week. So they didn't have any other offensive linemen left. And they didn't really seem to adjust. The Titans spent this entire game rushing four guys. Now, they didn't always rush four defensive linemen. They sometimes would drop a guy out. They would hide, but they were rushing four guys one way or another and then dropping seven into coverage, usually in zones, and sort of playing fire zones behind those front four. And the Browns never adjusted to that. They didn't run a lot of floods. They didn't try to get the ball out quick. They didn't, you know, make adjustments to try and account for where these rushers were coming from, to the point where, the Titans were getting pressure on second and 19 rushing four against the Browns offensive line. And that's scary. You shouldn't be able to do that in the NFL. And, you know, would they have adjusted quicker if Freddie Kitchens had just been the OC or just been the quarterback's coach and someone else had been taking, you know, command of the snap-to-snap duties as a head coach? I think it's impossible to say. We won't know for a while, but I think it was absolutely disconcerting. And I thought Baker Mayfield played okay in this game, but it did seem like as the game wore on, when they didn't have answers, it sort of became Baker Mayfield hero ball, where he was forcing throws into very narrow windows and, you know, maybe trying to hit receivers who weren't necessarily on the same page as him. And that turned out disastrously.
Yeah, it did. And I think it is worth noting one of the other things too. And like, I didn't like talking about this in the offseason because I really like Baker Mayfield. Sure. I think when you see him make the big time plays he makes, you can tell he is going to be a very good quarterback. He, provided that the coaching and around him and his physical health is fine, or, you know, at least an adequate level, he's going to become a really good quarterback in the league. But when you go back and look at the stretch, you know, even after you know, Hugh Jackson was gone, they got hammered by the Houston Texans, who were a top 10 unit in DVOA. They struggled against the Broncos, and if Vance Joseph hadn't gagged that away, you know, they would have lost that game. They were a top 10 or top 5 team in DVOA. They lost to the Ravens in the final week of the season, and Baker was pressured. That was a top 5 or top 10 in DVOA. Mm-hmm. When Baker got hot against – I'm not trying to bash Baker Mayfield, but he got hot against a lot of teams that weren't very good, including racking up a ton of points and a ton of yardage against the Cincinnati Bengals in those Hugh Jackson revenge games that somehow morphed into a reality. And when you look at the Titans, you know, I think we're talking about a team in Tennessee that is probably going to be a pretty good defense. I mean, they finished the year, I think they were they were 19th in DVOA, so they weren't great in defensive DVOA last year. But to me, they have a complete roster in terms of defense. They have Cameron Wake, Carroll Landry, Wake they added. Landry should develop. The secondary is very good. And so, you know, I just feel like it is worth noting that Baker has not been fantastic at all times against stronger defenses. Also worth noting, Bill, we're talking about people who picked the Titans and the Browns. Mm-hmm. Our friend Mina Kimes. I'm looking at NFLPickWatch.com here. Mina would have been 13-0 picking NFL games going into Monday night if she just picked the Titans. Or I guess 12-1-1 or 12-0-1.
She didn't pick the tie?
She didn't pick the tie. It's pathetic. What are you doing, Mina? Come on.
Right. Got to throw at least one tie in there every week. Just
91% of the people, of the experts tracked on this site, and that includes ESPN, CBS, Sporting News, SB Nation, MMQB, all kinds of tons of people. 91% of the people picked the Browns to win that game straight up.
Yeah. I mean, the Titans are a team that were pretty consistently the least favorite team in the AFC South. They were the fourth likeliest team to win the division in Vegas until the Andrew Luck retirement. Mm-hmm. This is a team that was, even though they were 9-7, they were one game away from being a playoff team, and they had to start Blaine Gabbert in week 17 because of injuries. I mean, we saw what happens. This is, when they're healthy, this is a really talented football team. And I think, you know, obviously things kind of fell apart at the end for the Browns, and you're not going to hit Derrick Henry for a 75-yard screen pass for a touchdown every week. I don't think that's exactly Derrick Henry's game, but this is a team that's going to give, you know, it's going to be inconsistent from week to week based on history, but they're going to give good teams fits. They have the talent to make this work week after week if they can just stay healthy. On the Browns side of things, I don't want to be too alarmist. You never want to say that something's a must win in week two. I don't think it's necessarily fair to say, but their schedule week two.
Bad, Bill.
Yeah, Rams at Ravens at Niners, who that game was a disaster. Don't watch Niners Bucks if you
care. But it's still a Monday night game in San Francisco. Yeah. I mean, Kyle Shanahan can't scheme up something, and their defensive line is good. Like, they have talent on the defensive line. It's a kind of a bad matchup for the Browns, frankly.
Yeah. They host Seattle, and then after the bye, they're at the Patriots. I mean, they might not.
The Broncos.
Yeah. I mean, they might not be favored. Maybe at home against the Seahawks, maybe if the Niners really look bad, they'll be favored slightly against the Niners. But there's a decent chance they're underdogs in Vegas in their next five games. Maybe at least four of their next five games.
There's a non-zero chance that they are coming out of their bye in week 8, going to New England, and that they are 0-6. I don't think it's likely, but it's a non-zero chance.
Right, or 1-5. And I mean, if you had gone through their schedule before the year and done the thing I hate, which is just penciling in wins and losses, every single Browns fan would have penciled in a victory in week one against the Titans. That was the one you had to grab before the schedule got tough, and maybe you get lucky and you pull out a win over the Rams at home, or you beat the Ravens in Baltimore, or, you know, you top the Seahawks in Cleveland. But this could be an ugly start. I mean, the schedule does get easier in the second half of the run, but
I will add one thing, and this is more of a Spidey sense thing than anything else. Mm-hmm. Three of their next four games are on the road. Three of those four games are also, with the exclusion of the Ravens game, are in prime time. And I am curious if Baker Mayfield may or may not have a little bit of the Russell Wilson flair for the prime time. It would not surprise me if Baker Mayfield was exceptional in prime time over the course of his career. He just has that about him. But we'll see. Next 4 weeks, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, I think to that point, you know, we haven't seen the Browns really deal with serious adversity, which is sounds to say, but last year, you know, it was sort of a free roll. The Browns were playing well, and it was, you know, expectations were low heading into the season, and so, you know, finishing 7-1 was great. I don't think anyone expected much more from that from the Browns, but now that the expectation is we're going to make the playoffs, if they get off to a 1-5 or even a 2-4 start, which I think would be great, given the upcoming schedule over the next few weeks, I mean, we're going to have to see Baker Mayfield and Odell Beckham deal with adversity and deal with those struggles. And Odell has experience with the Giants, of course, but that didn't always go well. And we're going to have to see Freddie Kitchens manage expectations in that locker room and sort of get everyone on the same page to, you know, kind of keep afloat until they get to the easier point of that schedule. And, you know, that's something that's not really analytics. It's not something that's really in my wheelhouse, but I do think it matters, and I do think it's something that the Browns really are going to have to deal with, just given how difficult their schedule is in the weeks to come.
I'm with you 100%. I would be highly concerned if I had bet the Browns over 9.5 wins, or we're sitting on a Browns division or Super Bowl future.
Yeah, and I think on the flip side, Tennessee now has the Colts in week 2. You win that game and you're 2-0. Jaguars are lost yesterday. The Texans are underdogs against the Saints tonight. You have the Colts, who lost in the opener, looked pretty good against the Chargers. I think, you know, gave them a scare certainly, but obviously kicking woes there, strangely, without Vinatieri. You know, they could be in really good shape in the AFC South after 2 weeks.
The Titans beat the Browns by 30 points, and their next two games are against divisional opponents. One who has a quarterback that abruptly retired at the age of 29 3 weeks ago, and the next team has a quarterback who broke his collarbone in week one and will certainly be out for that game. And then they get the Falcons on the road, which is not easy, but Falcons don't look great. So, yeah, I mean, the Titans, pretty good 24 hours for the Tennessee Titans.
Oh, one more question about the Ravens, and then we'll get to our final game here. The 35-3 fake punt. How do you feel about it?
I watched it again today, and this is a great question. I mean, I actually meant to bring it up. My initial reaction was, dang, John Harbaugh is savage for doing that. Mm-hmm. But then the more I thought about it, and I think Andrew Catalan mentioned this. I think he was on the broadcast. But I actually kind of like putting that on film early in an insane way, because I think you're going to put people on high alert moving forward. Mm-hmm. If you're the Ravens, like, I know you could have saved it for later, but you put that out there and you let them know you're not afraid to go for the throat. They have the Chiefs, Browns, and Steelers in the next 4 weeks. So I think maybe a little bit of gamesmanship from John Harbaugh to let people know that the Ravens came to play, and that maybe they'll be faking some punts in the future, but maybe not. Either way, you're going to have to worry about it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it wasn't like it was some super elaborate, you know, hidden ball trick fake punt. It was just they ran forward. Like, it wasn't like it, you know, in terms of fake punts, it wasn't exactly the most, you know, elaborate or the sort of play that you can only get away with running once. Like, if you have the opportunity to run that play, it's going to work. It reminds me of the actually the Titans fake punt against the Texans last year, where the Texans just didn't cover the gunner on one side of the field, and Kevin Byard was there like, okay, I guess I'll just throw a ball to this wide open receiver for a touchdown, because, you know, why not? Why not take advantage of this opportunity with the Texans not covering one side of the field? So
also the Ravens, I mean, the Ravens were up 35-3, and it felt like the game was over. But you know what? The Lions were up 24-6. and it felt like the game was over in the fourth quarter, and they ended up tying. So it's the first half. Why would you, if you take your foot off the gas then, you're mentally putting yourself in a position where you're going to play conservatively for the rest of the game, and that could come back to bite you against better teams. And you just, like, it's the same thing as Belichick calling that timeout at the end of the game on Sunday night. Like, I think he was sort of sending a message maybe to Mike Tomlin, but also saying, like, look, no, it's the end of a game. I don't care what the score is. We play to the whistle. We're not being sloppy. Get out there and cover these guys and execute it as best you can.
Yeah, I think absolutely. They're pros. They're making money. The Dolphins had a lot of things to be upset about on Sunday. I don't think the fake punt really made that much of a difference in the long run. Let's finish up by, you sort of alluded to the Falcons a moment ago. Vikings-Falcons was not what I was expecting. I don't think if you'd asked me before the game, I would have said Kirk Cousins was going to throw 10 passes and we were going to see the Vikings, or the Falcons look like a mess on offense, but for the majority of the game, that's what we got. We got a Vikings team that looks great running the football and a Falcons team that sort of seemed to have the same old issues even after replacing Steve Sarkisian and after getting everyone back healthy on defense.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about the Falcons, Bill, is that we got so caught up in their injuries on defense that we didn't pound the table for it. They were 12th in adjusted games lost, which is above average. Mm-hmm. They've been really lucky in terms of health on offense for the last few years. And so even though that they were low in terms of adjusted games lost at Football Outsiders on defense, they were really more like an average team in terms of health. And the way that balances out this year is maybe the defense is healthy. What if the offense isn't healthy? Because it now appears that Chris Lindstrom, their first round pick, first offensive lineman taking the first round, has a foot fracture. I would assume that's going to knock him out.
He actually just got named. He was just placed on IR as we're recording this.
There we go. So he's placed. I would assume he's at bare minimum an IR, maybe with a designation to return. But a foot fracture is not ideal for a lineman or really anybody having to use their feet. And then Caleb McGarry, their other first round pick, he has some heart issues too, and I believe he was pulled out. And when you look at kind of where Atlanta is, I mean, man, Minnesota got after Matt Ryan. I mean, that, like, they drafted two offensive linemen in the first round because they were worried they couldn't protect Matt Ryan. They were worried they couldn't run the ball effectively. And they didn't do either against what looked like a great Vikings defense. Maybe more concerning is that Minnesota's new offense, which, we talk about the ecosystem in Baltimore. I have been pounding the table all offseason.
Yeah.
The addition of Gary Kubiak, who runs zone blocking. That's what Dalvin Cook was, the zone blocking scheme with the bootlegs. Everybody knows all that. Dalvin Cook ran exclusively zone blocking, in a zone blocking scheme at Florida State. It's his bread and butter. He thrives off the one cut. He's so explosive. And if he stays healthy, I bet on him to lead the league in rushing at 20-1. I wish I'd bet more on it.
Yeah.
Kirk Cousins came up with Mike Shanahan, who was Gary Kubiak's mentor. Garrett Bradbury, my guy out of NC State, who I picked as offensive rookie of the year kind of as a joke, but I think it'd be funny if it happened. 95% plus of his snaps in his final season at NC State in terms of running plays were in zone blocking schemes. They built an ecosystem that is going to make Mike Zimmer happy, allow them to run the ball, that is going to mitigate the things that Kirk Cousins doesn't do well, which is when you're forced to rely on him too much as maybe the primary guy in the offense. And they set up a system that is built on play action. And so you can flood the field with these receivers. I didn't love how they pass protected for Kirk Cousins. Didn't think that was very good. And, he only threw 10 times. It's a Mike Zimmer fever dream. I mean, he just like sitting at home, like drinking a glass of Pinot Noir in a bubble bath with still got his Viking cap on and his little glasses. And he's just sitting there like thinking about, we just won a game and my quarterback threw 10 times. I mean, it's a Mike Zimmer fever dream. I would be deeply concerned if I'm the Atlanta Falcons because, they appear to be exposed on the offensive line. They dealt with injuries and, I'm not sure that the defense is necessarily going to be good. It has never been good by DVOA, at least in the last 3 years under Dan Quinn. They have a lot of young talent. The presumption is it would always come together, and it's early, but that was a not an ideal start for Atlanta, who was, its final score was like 28-13 or whatever. It wasn't that close.
Yeah, it was 28-12 because the Falcons had two late touchdown drives, with Calvin Ridley and Julio Jones. I mean, I think what really struck me about watching Dalvin Cook in this game was it wasn't just, it was like a Saquon Barkley performance where he was just making everyone miss. He had some pretty impressive runs, but I mean, there were huge holes off the edges in this mm-hmm. game. It was not hard for the Vikings to set a strong edge and for Dalvin Cook to turn up field and make guys play. He did run over, if I'm not mistaken, Deion Jones at one point. But, I mean, this was a game where Alexander Mattison came in and looked great when Dalvin Cook was on the sidelines. He had 9 carries for 49 yards. And it wasn't like what they were doing was subtle or that the Falcons couldn't have expected it. I mean, you know, you bring in Gary Kubiak. This is what you're going to do in offense. This is the offensive scheme you're going to run. This is the concept you're going to run. And the Falcons had no answer. I mean, it really was not pretty to see them get run over. And I think even if things do go right for them, and I think they're going to be okay. They're certainly going to be good on offense and they're going to have better days on defense. There's certainly talent there, but I mean, they used 2 first round picks on offensive linemen and for an offense that was already pretty great and on a defense that has not been good for any long stretch of time in the regular season under Dan Quinn. They've been great in the postseason for reasons I cannot mm-hmm. explain, but you know, they didn't add a lot of talent to this defense. They kind of figured, okay, if we get everyone back healthy, we're going to be good. But even that version of that team has not been good for any stretch of time. And there's a chance they're not very good. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But I think even before we saw what happened in week 1, the Falcons didn't do enough to invest in this defense in the offseason. Even if it does work out and they play great, I still think, even given the offensive line issues they had, they needed to do more to address what has been a very bad defense and a defense that was very quickly exposed with run issues by the Vikings in week 1.
Yeah, and the really crazy thing, Bill, is that, you know, I think Thomas Dimitroff is considered a fairly analytics-friendly sure. guy, right? He traded up to get another first-round pick and use it on an offensive lineman after using a first pick on an offensive lineman in a draft that I think by most draft analyst and even, you know, a recreational draft analyst like myself mm-hmm. Was extremely deep from 15 to 45, maybe 15 to 70 with great defensive players. Like there were a ton of defensive players in the draft in the spots when they could have got them. And I believe I have to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure I had the Falcons as losers, even though Matt Ryan might be a winner because they passed on all these chances to get, you know, guys that could have helped them. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, Greedy Williams is a guy there, or even if you want to add an offensive player. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, Miles Sanders, Lonnie Johnson. I'm just listening. Paris Campbell, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside, you know, Juan Thornhill is a guy the Chiefs got at the end of the second round, right? I mean, yeah. You know, these are all there were players out there who in this draft you did not want to trade up. I mean, Terry McLaurin had a 100-yard game for the Redskins. Chase Vinovich was a 3rd-round pick, right? I mean, like, yeah. there were all these guys out there, and it just felt foolish to try and move up the way that Dimitroff did at a position where I think typically it takes a lot of adjustment. And if, you know, if these guys get hurt, you're in real trouble. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the Falcons are – You probably know the theorem for it, but it's sort of, I don't know if it's a gambler's fallacy, but I feel like mm-hmm. the Falcons are chasing that Super Bowl window that they think they pried open, and maybe they didn't, maybe it wasn't as open as they thought it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're mistaking the best case outcome, the 90th percentile yes. outcome from this defense, which was what we saw during the 2017 or 2016 Super Bowl run, and then again in the 2017 playoffs, and mistaking that for the most likely outcome from this team. And yes. that has not been the case. It hasn't been the case for any stretch of time, even when these guys have been healthy. And, you know, I think you can win games by just dominating on offense and having a defense just creates turnovers. I think the Chiefs are an example of what you can do there and sort of hope that the defense does get better. But I mean, week 1's not a good start. Week 1 has not been a good start for that strategy. And now they're at home in week 2, which is great, but they're playing the Philadelphia Eagles, who looked bad for a half, but then dominated in the second half against Washington, and who have the sort of defensive line that can give backup linemen, give backup offensive linemen issues. Certainly the Falcons are deep on their offensive line, but I mean, this could be another game.
I mean, look, the Colts did a good job. I mean, I think the Colts have a better front. Justin Houston was threw back the clock last against the Chargers. Phillip Rivers has played great. But I think the Colts have a decent defense. The Titans, you know, wreaked havoc with the Browns, and then the Texans have J.J. Watts. I mean, yeah. Like their next four games are not easy matchups. Two are on the road. The one saving grace for the Falcons is that most of their division schedule, in fact, all of their division schedule, comes after the Week 9 bye. So you could, if you can float around 500, you know, you could still win your division because you have those games late. But if everybody's banged up, it's harder. And then the other thing that I would say too, they only have three games outdoors all season long.
That's true.
That's incredible. And their first is not until November 17th at the Panthers, which is. It's just wild to think about that the scheduling gods would gift them that. So I think they can put together a run because of how the team is built. But I would be very worried if the supposed strength of this team, the offensive line that they rebuilt is suddenly a weakness and the defense is not in that 99th percentile outcome that they believe it could be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this helped. Carolina lost a home game in Week 1. Tampa lost a home game in Week 1. Saints, you know, they could lose tonight. I think they're going to win, but who knows if the Saints lose in Week 1, the NFC South is kind of where it was before the week started. But I think absolutely. I think just like with the Browns, where you sort of had a fear of, okay, this is what could happen. If they don't live up to expectations, this is how they're most likely to lose. I think we saw the same thing from the Falcons in terms of this is the exact way they would struggle and that the offensive line wouldn't deliver the way it was expecting. And, you know, Dirk Koetter wouldn't fix the red zone problems or wouldn't fix the offense, which was still pretty good last year. And then the defense wouldn't take the step forward I think Falcons fans have been waiting for over the last few seasons.
Well, I would also like, before we go, just to throw out the possibility that my Super Bowl pick, the Minnesota Vikings, might just be freaking awesome.
Yeah, that's also true.
it could be possible. They looked really good. It's a great first week, but you know, it's a long season. And so, did you mention on this podcast? I might have missed it. Did we wager on teams in Vegas together?
We have a small syndicate with you and me, and my former broadcast partner Robert Mays. Unfortunately. That syndicate is currently 0-1, given that the bet was on the Carolina Panthers to win the Super Bowl. And
I think they're fine. They should have won. They should have won that game. We can get into that later.
We'll get into that in the future, Will. But until then, if people want to listen to more of your audio and written efforts, where can they do that?
They can listen to the Pick 6 podcast on iTunes. Just search Pick 6 podcast or Will Brinson. I think it'll pop up in your Apple podcast app on your phone. You can go to cbssports.com and also check me out on Twitter at Will Brinson.
Awesome. Will, it's always a pleasure. Get ready for October. Get prepping. We will have you back on then, but thanks so much for hopping on the show.
All right, Bill. Always fun, buddy.
All right. Thanks so much to my guest today, CBS's Will Brinson. And oh, by the way, if you want to hear a podcast with an equally well-known guest as my friend Will, you can check out the Adam Schefter podcast as we agree talks with someone by the name of Randy Moss. I think you might be more familiar with him. But remember to subscribe to the Adam Schefter podcast and this very podcast, the Bill Barnwell Show, wherever you get your podcasts. And we have more audio coming later this week. We're back with the 2X per week podcast. So we'll preview week 2 later on in the week. Thanks so much for listening.